Oh, great. Okay. Thank you very much. Stay tuned, folks.
Thank you.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Jenka Soderberg speaks with Craig Corey about his family's appeal of an Israeli verdict ruling that the government was not responsible for the death of his daughter, Rachel Corey. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints asks, was the Egyptian election rigged? Also, a group of Nobel laureates question whether Human Rights Watch has been infiltrated and watered down by its close connections to the U.S. State Department, and a report from the Electronic Intifada. On the Radio Zine, starting at 11, host Bruce Silverman marks today as an important day in KBOO's proto-history, 1964 to 1968. And at 11:30, Megan Murphy, founder and editor of the website Feminist Current, talks about the killings committed by Elliot Rodger and the misogynist cultural messages we see today. Keep it locked right here on 90.7 FM KBOO Portland, your community radio.
Nine years after filing a civil lawsuit against the State of Israel for the wrongful death of American peace activist Rachel Corey, her family had their appeal heard before the Israeli Supreme Court on May 21st in Jerusalem. The appeal challenged the Haifa District Court's August 2012 ruling, which concluded that the Israeli military was not responsible for Rachel's death and that it conducted a credible investigation. The Corey family appeal focuses on flaws in the lower court verdict, which they say ignored facts and misapplied legal norms. Rachel Corey, a 23-year-old human rights defender from Olympia, Washington, was crushed to death on March 16, 2003 by an Israeli military bulldozer while nonviolently protesting the demolition of Palestinian civilian homes in Rafah, Gaza. The following day, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon promised President George W. Bush a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation into Rachel's killing. In 2004, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff informed the Corey family of the U.S. government's position that the Israeli investigation did not meet these standards and advised them to use the Israeli court system. The Coreys filed suit in 2005, charging the State of Israel and its Ministry of Defense with responsibility for Rachel's killing. Testimony in the civil trial began in 2010 and included military witnesses who testified that they saw protesters in the area and the on-site commander asked them to stop operations due to their presence, but was ordered by higher-ups to continue the demolition of the Palestinian home that Rachel was standing in front of. This contradicts the claim made by the Israeli government in court that the driver of the bulldozer could not see Rachel when he struck her. At the trial, an Israeli colonel testified that there are no civilians in war, and the lead military police investigator stated his belief that the Israeli military was at war with all in Gaza, including peace activists. Testimony also revealed flaws in the Israeli military's investigation into Rachel's killing. Investigators failed to question key military witnesses, including those who recorded communications. They failed to secure the military video, allowing it to be taken for nearly a week by senior commanders, with only segments of the video submitted to court. They failed to address conflicting testimony given by soldiers and ignored statements in the military log confirming a shoot-to-kill order. After the appeal hearing in Israel, the late Rachel Corey's father, Craig Corey, joined us by phone from Haifa outside the courthouse. This is Jenka Soderberg and Mohammed Usraf, and we are here with Craig Corey on the line from Israel. Can you tell us first about the verdict that you were appealing? I understand that the Israeli government ruled, or the court ruled, that the government was not responsible for the death of Rachel. Maybe you could start by telling us about that.
Yeah, that's true. Of course, the ruling actually came out in the lower court on August 28th of 2012. So it's been some time, and the whole lawsuit was filed really on the last day that we could file it, which was March 15th, 2005. So it's been a long journey, and Rachel was killed on March 16th, 2003. So more than 11 years later. Actually, the case was dismissed, although all the testimony was heard before that decision was made. And what they said is that Rachel was killed as an act of war. And so Israel, they claim, is not responsible for what it does as an act of war. And in appealing, we had three major areas that we were appealing on. So one was just exactly that. The other was on, and that's really international human rights law that applies there. And the other, another part of that is international humanitarian law, which says that actually the occupied territories, you can't be at war with a country or an area that you're occupying. And so a little bit different branch of international law applies there. And you actually have an active duty to protect the people that are in the occupied territory. So we feel that they violated that. Also, part of our claim was what's called in court evidentiary damages. And so that basically goes to the idea that there was not a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation, as was promised by Prime Minister Sharon to President Bush. And so when you don't have a good investigation, that really harms figuring out what goes on in court. So our court proceedings, while at least we have the ability to have an attorney cross-examine the state's witnesses, you still don't have a adequate investigation going there. And then the last thing is that the Israeli military said there was no negligence. So in a lawsuit, you really don't have to prove that somebody intended to harm you. It could be by negligence as well, and it doesn't really matter in a civil lawsuit. But they were claiming that they weren't at all negligent. Now, what I point out is part of their argument that they couldn't be negligent is that they brought experts to say that they really couldn't see very well out of the bulldozer, that the field of vision was quite narrow. And you know, to me, that isn't a defense against negligence. That's actually kind of a confession of negligence. If you can't see out of the bulldozer, you got no business starting it up and driving it around places. And there's certainly common sense sort of ways that you could do something to help in that. And they didn't do any of them. So, you know, they had three vehicles out there that day. So two vehicles could have been looking in front of the blade of this bulldozer. They also had a camera in the area that could see in front of that bulldozer. And knowing that there was a very poor field of vision, they could have mounted cameras on the bulldozers to see in those places. They did none of those things. In fact, they even disregarded their own operations manual for how to operate those heavy machinery in an area of what they call limited conflicts, i.e. the Gaza Strip. So for those three reasons in court, we appealed this. But I'd say when you put those together, what you've got is the continued impunity that the Israeli military enjoys for the actions that take place in this really horrific occupation.
In terms of the U.S. government, the U.S. government in 2005 called for an investigation. And we are wondering, like, if what's the role that the U.S. government played in this since that time, and what kind of support the U.S. government did for you?
Well, in terms of a U.S.-led investigation, we pursued that pretty heavily, and the in that actually got into the Attorney General's office, the Justice Department, and they determined that they were not willing to do any sort of investigation. They wouldn't tell us how up they that decision was made, but anyway, they declined to investigate that. And that was under the Bush administration that was determined. Now, in terms of the support that we've gotten here and with the State Department, we've been in contact with the State Department all along, and even with the White House now under the Obama administration, and have some access to that. And, for instance, there has been somebody from the embassy here in Israel at every day we were in court, and that includes, there were two people from the embassy, and the Consul General Meyer represented the embassy when we were at the High Court yesterday. So we appreciate that. We had a meeting with the Ambassador Shapiro, and I thought that was a productive meeting. We talked about some things there and came to understanding on things about the court case and just really other things that we're dealing with here. So we appreciate that help. But, of course, at the end of the day, it was a promise of one head of state to another head of state. And as a father, I just don't have the means to enforce that sort of promise back and forth.
Wow. Well, do you see, what kind of contrast do you see between the U.S. government's response that you're talking about, or lack thereof, and the British government in responding to the deaths of two British citizens around the same time as Rachel, Tom Herndahl and James Miller?
Yeah, there really is a lot of difference in that, and some of it is structural between the laws of the two countries. So, had Rachel died in the United States, then there would have been a coroner's inquest from in Washington State. It would depend on the county that she died on in. But because she died in Rafah, there's no coroner's inquest in the United States. But that's not true in London. So for both James and Tom, there were coroner's inquests into their death. And in fact, those two inquests were combined to ask if there was any systemic problem that led to both of them being killed. And so I've forgotten, but one was found to be a wrongful death, and I think that was in Tom's case. And in James' case, it was considered murder. So with that then was taken to their foreign minister at the time, Jack Straw, and they actually, I think in James's case, were trying to get extradition for the people that killed him. So that the UK and their government actually pursued that quite vigorously, and they actually helped in our case too in what I think may have been a very significant way, but we were getting, we became concerned that the Israeli government was not going to let our witnesses in to come to the trial. And several of those were from the UK. And I wrote an email to the the UK's ambassador to Israel and asked for his help, and he kind of wrote back right away, well, wait a minute, you're an American citizen, I can't help. And I said, yeah, but, you know, the witnesses are from your country, and he was on it right away. He said, I just talked to the U.S. ambassador, and we're on that. So, you know, so they were helpful in our case as well.
Craig, about the Gaza Strip and as like Rachel Khoury was killed in Rafah in 2003. So what kind of support the Gaza people and the Gaza Strip like did to the whole process since that time till now?
Well, you know, the people of Rafah are really in our hearts as they were in Rachel's. So their support really started long, you know, when Rachel first got there. I think of it because she wrote so warmly of the people that she met and made them come alive before I managed to get there and meet them. So I remember when she was killed that I wanted to thank the people of Rafah for being her parents when we couldn't be, because I just know that, you know, how she loved the people that she met there and how much they meant. And, she, you know, she wrote to us that what she was doing was the most important thing she'd ever done in her life. So after that, we managed to get to Rafah in the fall of 2003, so about 6 months after Rachel was killed. And we got to meet the family that was behind the wall that Rachel stood in front of and many others down there. And they've been friends ever since. We've only managed to get to Rafah and Gaza five times, but we have managed to get there five times. And the last time was in the fall of 2012. We left just as Israel started bombing the area. So we were scheduled to go out the next day, and we did go out because the people, you know, our friends in Gaza, we try to take care of the dumb Americans who wouldn't know enough to come in out of the bombs, I think was what they were afraid of. And so we were actually, in some ways, we felt like we were maybe endangering the people that we came to meet and be with. And so we had to leave. But they've been a great help. I'd also say it's kind of surprising to people, but, you know, there's a play, My Name is Rachel Khoury, that was taken from Rachel's writing, and that's been all over the world in, I think, at least 20 languages. But it played here in Jaffa in Hebrew, and we were able to see that Monday night. So a lot of people don't realize that we actually have quite a bit of support from inside Israel and from the Jewish community here of activists, and they packed the theater Monday night. It was an excellent production. We've also seen in that same theater in 2008 in a Arabic production, and which was also delightful. So I don't choose between the productions ever because I love them all. But it was really heartwarming that people, as a deliberate act of solidarity with us, managed to do that. And of course, the people at Gaza can't get out. You know, they can't come and support us at trial. They can't come and see us. And you know, it's very difficult for them to even get to the United States or to Europe, let alone, and Israel's the hardest place for them to get, or the West Bank, for instance. So I know we get messages from them. Their hearts are with us. But unfortunately, of course, they can't be with us. That's what part of the struggle is about.
You know, you mentioned the play, My Name is Rachel Khoury, and I know that you and the members of the family have also put together a book of Rachel's writings that came out recently. And I wonder, as somebody from the Pacific Northwest right here in our area, how do you think was Rachel inspired to take action in such a faraway place as Gaza?
Well, like everybody, I think, she was appalled at what happened on September 11th in 2001. And she was going to school at Evergreen State College up in Olympia at the time. And she started to ask questions about, you know, how did this come to be? And she was for some reason, unsatisfied with President Bush. I think he said they hated us because of our freedom or some garbage. And anyway, she didn't buy that. And so she started looking into it. And, you know, one of the reasons, or it's certainly one of the stated reasons that Osama bin Laden talked about, I don't know if it's true, but he talked about the occupation of Palestine. And so Rachel started to learn about it and realized that this has been a festering sore here in the Middle East for a long, long time, all of my lifetime. And she realized that American citizens really had the wrong impression about that, that most of us, our families certainly, knew the Jewish narrative, and Cindy read to the kids when they were little about Anne Frank, and then other stories where the Jewish children might have survived. But we didn't know the Palestinian story. She started to learn about that. She had professors that had a great deal of experience here. One who was Israeli, well, I think still is an Israeli citizen, and had once served with the Israeli Defense Force and then become so angry about what went on in the first Lebanon War that she was one of the co-founders of Women in Black here in Israel, protesting those abuses. So Rachel learned about this from people that had come here. Some of her friends came to be part of the International Solidarity Movement in 2002, in the summer of 2002. She started to study Arabic, and so she could speak to people while she was here. And then, she came and first came to the West Bank and got a day or two of training with the International Solidarity Movement, and then went deliberately down to Rafah, Gaza, to be with the people down there.
After 11 years of Rachel martyred in the Strip, and you were mentioning her writing, so can you tell us now, after all of this time, like, what's, when you go and read her writing, what's the most touching story that Rachel ever write to you?
I think everybody gets something different out of that. I love Rachel's writing, so I think when I look at her writing, and a couple of things come through. You know, she, through a lot of that time, she was a teenager, and teenagers don't always totally agree with their fathers all the time, and so it's interesting to see what she was thinking about, what she was writing, at a time when she might have been arguing with me. And now I kind of think that she was right more often than I was. But at the time, I didn't. And so that's kind of an interesting thing about it. But also, I think what I see going throughout Rachel, both in knowing her and in reading her writing, and I think it's clear in her writing and different things that you see, that throughout her life, really more than anybody else I knew, she refuse to look away from marginalized people. So a lot, you can go out to the internet, you know, on YouTube, and you can see a speech she gave as a 10-year-old about ending world hunger, and that was part of a class project that they did. So other students, it wasn't like she did that all on her own, but it's a compelling speech that I run through my head a lot.
I'm here for other children. I'm here because I care. I'm here because children everywhere are suffering, and because 40,000 people die each day from hunger. I'm here because those people are mostly children. We have got to understand that the poor are all around us, and we're ignoring them. We have got to understand that these deaths are preventable. We have got to understand that people in third world countries think and care and smile and cry just like us. We have got to understand that they are us. We are them. My dream is to stop hunger by the year 2000. My dream is to give the poor a chance. My dream is to save the 40,000 people who die each day. My dream can and will come true if we all look into the future and see the light that shines there.
As a 12-year-old, she wrote what I think is a beautiful, you know, I'm a father, I'm partial. I think it was a beautiful poem about the homeless and how we would give them a dollar, you know, so we didn't really have to look at them and understand them. And she said, you know, what we were worried about is that that they could be us and we could just as well be them. I think there's a lot of truth to that. She worked in college, well, in high school, she worked on a teen care line, a call-in center for teens that might have problems, and you could refer them on to some place that they could get some sort of help or just listen to them. And by the time she was a senior in high school, she was working with the adult crisis clinic to take those calls. And through college, she worked with mentally ill and really enjoyed doing all that sort of work. So when you think about marginalized people, unfortunately, you know, the Palestinians are pretty marginalized people, and of them, then there's Gaza, which is even more isolated. And when you get to Gaza, you go down to Rafah, and, so sort of following that logic, I think she kind of ended up refusing to look away. And, of course, now, when you think about it, as isolated as Gaza is, you know, the whole world has refused to look at Gaza right now, and it's shameful. It's really unforgivable.
Thank you very much, Craig, for this important interview at this time, and was with you, Muhammad Nabil and Jinka.
Yeah, thank you so much. And again, we've been speaking with Craig Corey, the father of Rachel Corey, who was killed in 2003 in the Gaza Strip at the age of 23. The ruling that the Israeli court made that the Israeli government was not responsible for her death when she was crushed by an Israeli military bulldozer has been now appealed to the highest court in Israel this week. A ruling will be made in some months in the future, and we will continue to follow this story here on KBOO. Thank you so much, Craig Corey, for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We'll go out with a song by Portland-based folk singer David Rovix. The song is called The Death of Rachel Corey.
When she sat down in the dirt in front of your machine, a lovely woman dressed in red, you in military green. If you had met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date. But here you were in Gaza, rolling towards the gate. As your foot went to the floor, did you recall her eyes? Did her gaze remind you that you've become what you despise? As you rolled on towards this woman and ignored all shouts to stop, did you feel a shred of doubt as you watched her body drop? As your caterpillar tracks upon her body pressed with 60 tons of deadly force, crushed the bones within her chest, could you feel the contours of her face as you took her life away? Did you serve your country well on that cool spring day? This just another day in a dirty war. When you looked out on the water, did you feel an empty void? Or was it just one more life you've taken, one more home destroyed, one more home destroyed?
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59 a.m. Coming up at 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, followed at 11 by the incomparable Radio Zine. Thank you, KBU members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, that can be remedied when you go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, May 30th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. And again, we cannot thank you enough. Everyone who became a member of KBOO is a returning member of KBOO, is a renewing member of KBOO, and to all the volunteers that made the membership drive happen, thanks to all of you. A few headlines first before we speak with John Dean of Greenpeace. He's going to join us by phone from Colorado with some updates and news on what happened on that oil rig, the boarding of the ship in the Arctic. Greenpeace unstoppable. One correction, the activists were taken prisoner. They're in a prison in the Netherlands right now. We'll wait to find out from John what exactly is going to happen from here. One thing that we do know, and I can safely report, is that Greenpeace won't stop until the drilling in these far-flung places has been finally and forever put to an end. First, a few headlines, though. Rural counties and their crime. Across Oregon, taxpayers is an obsolete word. Voters vote themselves off the hook when it comes to paying for basic services. Again, American sense of entitlement. Everyone feels entitled to everything that they want, but no one feels that they ought to share